Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Last year, more than 160 million people filed tax returns. The average taxpayer paid almost $13,500 in federal income taxes. So where does that money go? Well, the National Priorities Project breaks down the numbers, and their findings say a lot about the priorities of the U.S. government. Just a few findings. The average taxpayer contributed about $2,000 to the military last year. Almost half of that went to corporate military contractors. That is more than five times the amount that went through to K-12 education at $171. $62 went to deportations and border control. Another $62 went to nuclear weapons, while only $7 went to anti-homelessness programs. That's just $7. Just $5 went to renewable energy at a time when we are trying to deal with the climate crisis and try to get it more attention. Just $5 is going to renewable energy. So what will it take to change this? Today, we're joined by Ashiq Siddiq, research analyst for the National Priorities Project, working on analysis of the federal budget and military spending. The National Priorities Project works to inspire individuals and movements to take action so our federal resources prioritize peace, shared prosperity, and economic security for all. Hi, Ashiq. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
So tell us how you break down these numbers year after year. For example, the average taxpayer paid almost $13,500 in federal income taxes. Tell us more about how you came up with that number.
Yeah, sure. So the reason NPP does this analysis every year of your what we call a tax receipt is that every year most Americans pay taxes, but it's very unclear to most people where that money actually goes. Like we don't get a receipt from the government itemizing, you know, how things are spent. We just pay our taxes and then, you know, we see whatever we see on the news about what the government is doing. So this is really meant to be a civic education project where we break down data that comes out every year from the federal government. So at the beginning of the year, usually in the first 3 months at some point, the administration puts out their proposed budget for the next year, which also includes a huge spreadsheet trove that includes all the spending from previous years, including the last year. So when that comes out, as it did this year in March, We take some time to just break that down into a digestible format, because the format it comes in and from the Office of Budget Management is just massive spreadsheets that are probably pretty difficult for most people to understand, right, or review, unless they're really familiar with Excel. So we just kind of break it down into 13 main categories of spending, and then break it down according to income taxes and other sources of federal funding. So you can see the results on our website.
It would be fascinating if people were given a receipt when they file their taxes. The other thing that I think about a lot is, what if we were able to vote on this? It would just be fascinating to see the outcome. So for example, you break it down based on issues like health, unemployment, Pentagon and military, government, interest on debt, education, veterans, food and agriculture, housing and community, transportation, on and on. So wouldn't it be fascinating if people were able to say, hey, this is how I want my tax dollars spent?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, a big motivating principle of the National Priorities Project is that budgets are moral documents. This is something that advocates have been saying for many years, that what the government chooses to spend money on reflects our morality, our priorities as, you know, as a society. But the way that the budget process works is really opaque. People elect, you know, the representative to Congress, but then it's often unclear, like, how that representative or all the representatives together, there are over 400 of them, like how they make these decisions in Congress. It's a pretty long, drawn out process. A lot of it happens in, you know, in back rooms, and we just hear about it on the news. But even that is not reported on very well.
Yeah, so, what explains that? Because you do hear, how are we going to pay for that, over and over again, when there was a debate around Build Back Better. Mm-hmm. Every single host and reporter, and that's a fine question, but it was the main question on so many of these segments. How are we going to pay for that? And yet there's really no conversation beyond that.
Yeah, and even that question just really is exposed as totally disingenuous when you look at something like the receipt that we put out that shows how much is spent on different sectors of spending, where you see how much is spent on militarized forms of spending versus all of the forms of social spending that you laid out, like just some of the trade-offs that we made, like spending over $900 per person for Pentagon contractors, which is five times more than the average taxpayer pays for K-12 education. We pay, the average taxpayer spends $62 for nuclear weapons, and also it's the same amount for deportations, border control, versus $7 for homelessness to actually house people, or $5 for renewable energy to transform our energy system as fast as we need to against the climate crisis. So if more people saw those trade-offs, then I think there would be very reasonable questions about, like, okay, how are those calculations made? Are our representatives even thinking in those terms, or are they just kind of, yeah, like, what is motivating them? And there's a lot more we could say about, you know, what's motivating them. But just the basic facts of how the money is being spent is not understood by most people.
And why do you think that is? Why don't you think this gets more attention, especially around tax day?
That's a great question. I think really one of the biggest reasons for at least for Pentagon spending is just the massive influence of the military industrial complex, which just is a really powerful lobby that pours a lot of resources into lobbying members of Congress to keep increasing the military budget year after year, much of which goes to private contractors who make weapon systems that often the military itself doesn't even want or doesn't find useful, but because it's so profitable and they're able to funnel those resources to particular districts, that is just a really powerful incentive to keep increasing this budget year after year. Whereas, you know, unhoused people don't have a very powerful lobby, or you know, public education, like there are teachers unions and, you know, families obviously that would want their schools to be well funded. But it just doesn't compare to the influence that many members of Congress are getting from, you know, Raytheon or Lockheed Martin. So that's something that accounts for why the military budget just keeps growing year after year. It's a big question how we can build a counterforce to that. But that's a matter of public organizing.
Right. And we'll talk about that during the show. Since you brought up military contractors, I was just looking for some profit information. And the Federal News Network reports that Lockheed Martin repeated as the top contractor in 2020, bringing in $75 billion in federal contracts. Wow, this is huge. So $75 billion in 2020, up from $43 billion in 2019. And then Lockheed, $74 billion, while the other top five, Raytheon, General Dynamics, Boeing, and Northrop Grumman, all saw decreases between 2020 and 2021 and 2020. I mean, it's really incredible when you think about it. How are we going to pay for it? And yet hardly any, and I feel like a broken record because we talk about this at least a few times a year on this show, but why this doesn't get more attention about how this money at Lockheed, Raytheon, billions and billions of dollars, how this money is actually spent. What is it spent on? What about the waste? Are there any hearings happening on Capitol Hill around this?
Yeah, that's a really big question. I mean, one of the big problems in the federal budget process is, especially around military spending, is that for many decades, there was not even any kind of audit of how the Department of Defense spends its money. And the military in general just never gets anywhere near the kind of scrutiny that other forms of federal spending get, like agencies like Social Security, like Medicare, are just constantly, you know, nitpicked for any irregularities, which, you know, probably most forms of government spending should get, but the military does not get that. So it was only in the past few years that the DoD got its first ever audit, which it failed. Like, there were just massive pockets of spending that were not accounted for. And that was just kind of seen as normal. Many spokespeople for the DoD were just like, oh yeah, well, you know, we didn't expect, you know, to have all this accounted for. So, you know, maybe we'll try again next time, which is pretty wild, that one of the biggest pockets of federal spending can just get away without this kind of scrutiny. So, that's a really big problem. I think it's starting to get more attention from the public, especially with social media. there's just it's easier to transmit the information, but the question of what people, like how many people it reaches and what people do with that, is still a very big question to figure out collectively.
It's also important to point out, and I don't think people know this, but when you look at how dollars are spent, the Pentagon and the military are separate from veterans issues. Mm-hmm. And so if you say this is how much people spend on the military, people might assume, well, I would like veterans to be taken care of at the VA, but that's a separate line.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And that's something that we at NPP always, you know, take pains to point out, where people are like, oh, well, you're talking about cutting military spending. What about, you know, our troops? What about veterans? And you're correct, veterans is a separate pocket of spending that we don't want to cut, that because that's something that, you know, people should be getting care for all the, you know, all the hardship that they're put through having served in the military. But it's also something we try to point out is the trade-off within the military budget between personnel and contractors. Like, many people assume that the military budget is going to support the troops, but actually just a fraction of it, about a fifth, is actually going to direct pay and benefits for personnel, and including the troops. Half of that almost is going to private contractors. So the military budget itself is not doing a great job of supporting the troops versus all these war profiteers.
No, exactly. And you're reminding me of a piece I heard on NPR about soldiers who struggle to make ends meet to the point where they have to rely on food banks. Mm-hmm. So when you look at the numbers, when you break it down, about $929 for military contractors, $62 almost for nuclear weapons. And then when you look at veterans, it's about $240 for Veterans Health Administration.
Yep. Yeah. And this is just, again, for the average taxpayer's portion of spending. If you multiply this out to, you know, the multi-trillion dollar budget, that's just that shows the disparity between between paying military contractors and supporting veterans, or even the troops themselves. So it's a pretty big difference.
I was going to ask you if you see major changes between Democratic and Republican administrations on certain issues. On the military, probably not, because here's an headline from The Guardian just a couple weeks ago. Biden's record defense budget draws progressive ire over spending priorities. The mm-hmm. Pentagon's $813 billion proposal is a 4% increase for the Pentagon, which already spends more than the next 11 countries combined.
Yeah. It really hasn't changed dramatically in the abstract picture from Republican to Democrat administrations over the past few decades. There might be some differences in emphasis on, you know, different things that are funded within the budget, but the overall number just keeps growing and growing. We're now approaching the highest level of military spending in the United States since World War II, which is just another thing that I think a lot of Americans probably don't understand. Like, this is, we're at a higher military budget now than at the height of the Vietnam War, at the height of the Cold War, all of which, you know, which were times when many Americans probably felt more of a direct sense of threat or something, whether or not that was justified. But now, at a time when the U.S. is by far the greatest military power in the world, the threats that are being talked about in terms of other nations like Russia or China, their military budgets are still a fraction of the United States. And if we're looking at, well, what's happening in Ukraine now with Russia, the United States' massive military budget was not enough to prevent that from happening. So if we're talking about increasing the military budget more now to deal with that, then I think people should have serious questions about that, like whether that's going to achieve whatever desired outcome people want to see in terms of countering, you know, the horrific things we're seeing in Ukraine from Russia.
You mentioned a little bit about audits before. Carol writes in, do you know the status of audits on the department? I remember hearing that they're trying to audit, but it's so complex and a lot of money has simply disappeared, so they avoid doing it. I just found a piece from CNBC in December that says the Pentagon has failed another audit this year, but with $770 billion expected to be budgeted for 2022, the Department of Defense said it's working on keeping track of all this money.
Yeah, there since the first audit a few years ago that I mentioned, there have been several more. But it's really going to be a question of political will to follow through on making these audits much more effective, because they even if they are happening, the Pentagon still keeps failing them, and that's just, justified by many people in Congress and by the DoD itself. So it's going to take a lot more political will from members of Congress and the public to say, we want a much more effective audit that can actually identify things that just need to be cut, and then follow through on the political will to cut those things, which is politically possible. That's in the realm of that's what Congress has power over. But there just is not the political will to do that.
According to the Center for Responsive Politics, five of the nation's largest weapons companies, Lockheed, Boeing, Northrop Grumman, excuse me, Raytheon, and General Dynamics, spent $60 million in 22 to influence policy. When you look at the larger picture, they spent $2.5 billion in lobbying over the last 2 decades, and they hired 200 lobbyists who previously worked in the federal government. Thanks to military.com for that information. Today, we're joined by Ashiq Sadiq, research analyst for the National Priorities Project. And every year, they take a look at how federal income taxes are spent. Last year, the average taxpayer paid almost $13,500 in federal income taxes. $2,000 went to the military, half went to corporate military contractors. This does not include benefits for veterans. 171 went to K through 12 education. $62 went to nuclear weapons. Only $7 went to anti-homelessness programs, and a measly $5 went to renewable energy at a time when that is desperately needed. If you have any questions or comments about how your tax dollars are spent, we'd love to hear from you. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. And what do you think it'll take to get this issue more attention? You can also email your call at kalw.org. Ashiq, what about these pathetic numbers? $7 for anti-homelessness problems, programs? Has that changed over time? And I wish that some reporters would ask, Biden and others, how can you justify just $7 at a time when we're in such a crisis across this country?
Yeah, well, I just want to say thank you as a reporter for raising these questions publicly and for having me on. I think that we need a lot more of that in the media, and failing that, I think it's very good for people on social media to talk about this more and more, because that brings it more to the attention of a lot of the people who need to be talking about it. I think so over the past 2 years during the COVID pandemic, there has been a little bit of a shift toward more federal spending towards social issues. Like in the annual breakdowns we've done of the tax receipt, for many years, the military was for a while the top category of spending, and then it was bumped down to number two after Medicare and health, because like health costs have gone up mostly because of insurance companies, which is a whole different issue. But in the past year, now the top two categories are health and then unemployment and labor, and military is number three. And that's because of the COVID pandemic and ongoing economic crisis, where in the past year, a larger share of federal spending than usual did go to unemployment and labor in particular, for all sorts of public welfare programs to help relieve all of the pressure people are feeling. But that's still not enough. Just the trade-offs we're seeing where, over twice as much is spent on prisons as for anti-homelessness programs. Like those kinds of trade-offs still really exist within the budget. Like even if more overall is being spent on public programs, it still really pales in comparison to military spending. And then there's still just major differences between what is spent on what we call the militarized budget, like beyond the military itself, things that are militarized programs like police or prisons or border enforcement. That is still like two-thirds of the overall discretionary budget.
And we should say, when we're talking about $7 for anti-homelessness programs, this is homeless assistance grants. Okay. And then
Yeah. And there's a lot more we could say about just housing policy. There's
that's
also a
exactly
separate
what I was going to
category.
ask. I was going to ask you about that next. Can you tell, just because, again, we're in such a housing crisis in this country, what did you find there?
Yeah, so there is so there's the homelessness assistance grants. There's also public housing funding, which is a separate pocket that I think we did not include that in this tax receipt, but it's sort of on the same scale as how much is spent on homeless assistance in terms of the overall amount of billions of dollars or the share of the average taxpayer's dollar. So it's there are different pockets of funding that are meant to help with the housing crisis, but it still really just does not compare at all. But what an important figure that we try to point to every year is that the amount of money it would take to solve the homelessness crisis in the United States to actually house all the unhoused people. I think there are currently at least 500,000 people who are unhoused, like to actually provide adequate housing for all of them. It would cost something like $15 to $20 billion, which, you know, sounds like a lot on its own, but it's a fraction of the many, many more billions of dollars that we spend, like over $800 billion this year on the military. So for a tiny fraction of that, we could solve homelessness, but wow, we're not doing that.
It's really incredible. The other one, before we talk about renewable energy, is public transportation. At a time when we desperately need better public transportation to ensure that people are not spending so much time in their cars, just $40 on public transportation.
Yeah. I mean, if you think about anybody who lives in a city that has, you know, a transit system, like think about however many hundreds of dollars you spend on train fare, the average taxpayer is spending only $40 of their tax money on the entire public transit system. And then if you think about, you know, if you live outside of a city or even within a city, if you drive a car, you're spending so much money on gas and car maintenance every year. But the federal government could be investing more of your tax money in, you know, just building working public transit systems. And that isn't happening either. And the amount of money that's going to highways, for example, like maintaining car infrastructure, that's way more than public transit. But if we wanted to have a better transit system, that could definitely shift.
That definitely needs to shift. And then renewable energy and energy efficiency, a measly $5.
Yeah. That's just one of the biggest pockets of spending that is, it's a tiny pocket of spending that should be way bigger if we were actually serious about the climate crisis. Like to actually shift our entire energy grid in the United States to renewable energy, which is technically possible, that would cost something like $4 trillion. Which sounds like a lot of money over a decade, but another study we did in the past year is that the cost of war since 9/11 over the 20 years has been like militarized spending for the past 20 years has been amounted to $21 trillion on foreign and domestic militarization. So for a fraction of that, we could have had 100% renewable grid by now.
Wow. Did you get much attention when you put out these numbers? Because you're all doing a great job on social media. There's this dollar that's kind of sliced up and it says where your one tax dollar goes. So this is another way to think about it. A 15 cents to the military, 4 cents to veterans benefits, 0.9, not even a penny to energy, not even a penny to science. Did you get many interview requests to highlight this so people have more information?
Yeah. We've been doing a push and we like the big study that I mentioned that we call the State of Insecurity, the Cost of Militarization Since 9/11, that we put that out on the 20th anniversary of 9/11 last fall and got a fair amount of attention for that. So we're continuing to push these numbers. Mostly I would say we're getting decent attention from progressive outlets. So we're hoping to keep pushing it.
I just wonder what your thoughts are before we let you go about how the taxes in general are talked about in this country, that people don't want to pay taxes because government is broken. I mean, we just hear this line all the time. But then, unfortunately, when you look at what happened under COVID, just in California, for example, the EDD was a mess. The IRS is, you know, woefully underfunded. And so you need more than a soundbite to talk about these issues. But the anti-tax, cut taxes crowd is really good with their messaging.
Yeah, they are. And it's tough on the other side. I think you're right, we don't have easy sound bites to say, actually, here are the good things we should be funding, because it's easier just to say, cut our, because people feel the money that's coming out of their wallets every year. The economy is already putting them under pressure. So it's hard to make the case for, like, actually, here's how your taxes can be spent better, because our government is not doing that. And there's just so much inertia there. But I think, especially in a time of ongoing economic crisis, like 2 years into a pandemic where we have all these major societal problems, I think all the conditions are there to say, these are not individual problems. This is not a matter of your individual choice as a consumer. Like, the government is not something where you can just buy products. These are massive social problems that have collective solutions if we put the resources into them. So I think framing it that way, and especially showing how much of the budget already goes to profiteers of the military and other things, like, it's going to these private companies that are not even delivering on the services that they're claiming they are. So I think, that's not an easy soundbite, but I think there are a lot of major dynamics that we can try to draw out and make people understand that right now, so much of our federal budget, like people's collective tax resources, are going to profiteers for these services versus actually delivering on real human needs, which should be the purpose of government.
Ashiq Sadiq is research analyst for the National Priorities Project, and every year they put out a graphic with studies that looking at how federal income taxes are spent. The average taxpayer paid about $13,500 in federal income taxes last year. 2,000 went to the military, half went to corporate military contractors. That doesn't include veterans benefits. $5 went to renewable energy. $7 went to anti-homelessness programs. Ashiq, thank you so much for your work, and thanks to all of you at the National Priorities Project. Thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
Thank you. Coming up after a break, we'll continue talking about taxes, about how so many middle-class Americans are paying more in an effective tax rate than the Forbes 400. How can we change that? This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will get the latest on Russia's almost 2 month invasion of Ukraine. The Kyiv Independent reports that despite heavily outnumbering Ukraine's air force, Russia has failed to achieve total air supremacy. Yet there is one aspect in which Russia's air force has been effective: the indiscriminate killing of civilians with bombs and rockets. More than 5 million Ukrainians have left the country. It's a population of about 44 million. That is tomorrow. Now we are going to continue talking about the tax system in the United States. It wasn't that long ago that the ultra wealthy paid a lot more in taxes. During World War II, the top federal income tax rate peaked at 94%. It stayed at about 70% for 3 decades. Today, the top 0.1% and giant corporations have rigged the system so drastically that some billionaires and corporations end up paying 0%, while working families are left to carry the burden. Joining us to talk about the tax system is Chuck Collins, director of the Program on Inequality and the Common Good at the Institute for Policy Studies, where he co-edits Inequality.org. Chuck Collins is also author of The Wealth Hoarders: How Billionaires Pay Millions to Hide Trillions. Hi, Chuck. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, Rose. Great to be with you.
Well, it's great to have you, Chuck. Before we had you on, we were talking about the National Priorities Project. Every year, they take a look at how federal income taxes are paid or are spent. How do we change this, where you've got so much money going to military, 171 going to K through 12 education, and just $5 going to renewable energy?
Yeah, no, there, I think it was great that you had Ashiq on. I heard the end of that conversation. And, changing the priorities, just understanding that, we don't need to raise the military budget every year. It's like a public works program that isn't creating anything that's useful for our communities. So I think we need to organize both around how our money is spent, and that's where National Priorities Project is so helpful. And then how do we create a fair tax system? So whatever it is we organize for government to spend money on, that the ultra wealthy are chipping in and paying their obligations along with everyone else. So it's really sort of two parallel struggles, but obviously really related, ultimately coming down to, you know, what kind of democracy, what kind of society are we going to have?
What do you think about how to talk about these issues, Chuck? I asked Ashiq this question. And, you know, the anti-tax, tax cut crowd, they're really good at sound bites. They're really good at just repeating things over and over again. I mean, look at where we are right now. Pretty shocking thinking about the fact that we have a climate crisis that we have to tackle. And yet these people are just passing these horrific anti-LGBT laws. It's really shocking when you think about where we are in this country right now.
It is. One thing I take heart in, Rose, is there is a much greater enthusiasm for making sure the ultra wealthy pay their fair share. And I think this is coming out of the pandemic and the sort of understanding like, okay, the billionaires and the ultra wealthy have done really well. They've seen their wealth surge during the pandemic. You know, other people are losing their lives, losing their jobs and struggling. There's something wrong with this picture. You use the word rigged. The system is rigged. And also that sort of trickle down theory, like, okay, if we give tax cuts to the rich, that's going to do some kind of magical, good, positive thing for our society. I think that those ideas are falling by the wayside. People are like 70-80%, majority of Republicans now are like, no, these wealthy people should be paying their fair share. There's something broken here. Mm-hmm. So I do think we're at the beginning of a sort of pivot. And the pandemic taught us, you know, you need to make public investments. Otherwise, look what happens. You need to invest in healthcare and public health infrastructure, or bad things happen. And so I think people are more attuned and open to a pro-tax, pro-investment message.
This is a very important point to make. It's almost head spinning, Chuck, because when you look at where the people are, study after study, like you say, when they get the information, they say, oh my gosh, this is wrong. We need to tax the wealthy, and especially the ultra wealthy. But then Republicans especially do the exact opposite. So you've got two things going on there where the people want one thing and yet the politicians are passing something completely different.
Yeah, I mean, it shows that the anti-tax and sort of the Republican narrative has kind of captured particularly national politics. But even there, it's starting to chip away. I mean, we had a sitting president who talked about taxing billionaires in his budget. Mm-hmm. That's sort of new, actually. You know, there's always been this like, oh, well, we don't want to talk that way. We don't want to alienate the donor class. But actually, the polls show this is good politics and good policy. So part of our job is to remind our elected officials, like, look, which side are you on? Are you going to continue to, you know, coddle the billionaires, give tax breaks for corporations and billionaires? Are you going to like work for the rest of us? And this is a particularly poignant moment to make those asks and put that pressure on.
Can you explain what has really changed over the last decades and where we are right now? I mean, it's so interesting to learn about how the ultra wealthy operate. You know, thanks to people like Jesse Eisinger, a reporter at ProPublica, who talks about how people like Jeff Bezos, for example, say that his salary is in the 80,000s. And so he only pays taxes on that amount, which is lower than a lot of people pay. And so what Jesse Eisinger said is that a lot of wealthy people will not sell their stocks because they don't want to be taxed. So what they do is they borrow and they pay a 0% interest rate. Whereas average people have no access to 0% interest rates and they have to pay based on their income. So it's just so interesting to think about how things have really changed for the ultra rich and how they deal with their money now to avoid paying taxes.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right, Rose, that, you know, the last 40 years, we've steadily been pulling apart as a society in terms of income and wealth. But the last 10 years, we're seeing an acceleration of aggressive tax avoidance by the ultra wealthy. And ProPublica and Jesse Eisinger's, you know, work and others has shown, you know, in part thanks to leaks, showing just how little the ultra wealthy pay and all these techniques. you know, in the book I wrote called The Wealth Hoarders, I look at what we call the wealth defense industry, the tax attorneys, accountants, wealth managers, who the ultra wealthy hire to kind of game and rig the system. And not only are they doing what Jesse describes, you know, let's borrow funds at zero interest because we have so much wealth, we can negotiate with banks and lenders and avoid taxes that way. They're also using trusts, offshore corporations, a whole like menu of aggressive avoidance. So thanks to leaks from and reporting from groups like ProPublica and the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, we're starting to get a very good picture of how the ultra wealthy have made their taxes almost voluntary at this point.
Right. So you have, according to these leaks, the top 25 billionaires paying 3.4% in federal income taxes between 2014 and 2018. Jeff Bezos paid less than 1% in that period. So it's incredible to think that in many ways it's really flipped. And the same applies to corporate taxes, where you look at how much corporations paid back in the 80s versus the average individual. And that has also flipped.
That's right. I mean, I'm always struggling, but trying to find a few positive stories here.
No, please do. That's fine. On this show, we tend to kind of go into the dark places and then we bring in the light. I mean, that's exactly kind of how we have to do things these days.
Absolutely. I think it is kind of interesting that the U.S. and 136 countries have now ratified a treaty around having a corporate minimum income tax of 15% at the global level. Now, there's still some work to be done here. But the fact that, you know, you think, oh, this is an international system, it's going to be really hard to fix this. Well, actually, we're kind of on the road to doing that. If, you know, the United States is the laggard here a little bit, but the Biden administration and other European, you know, OECD countries have basically come together and said, we're going to create a floor, no more pitting countries against each other in this race to the bottom of lowering tax rates. So I think we're going to start, we sort of have hit bottom and maybe we're turning toward raising corporate taxes, shutting down some of these loopholes, exposing and, you know, the hidden wealth system and shutting down some of the escape hatches. I'm starting to see that happening, and there's more of a political will to do that.
Chuck Collins is director of the Program on Inequality and the Common Good at the Institute for Policy Studies, where he co-edits inequality.org. Be sure to check out that website. It's got so much great information. Chuck Collins is author of The Wealth Hoarders, How Billionaires Pay Millions to Hide Trillions. And if you have any questions or comments about what it will take to, gosh, in some ways, just bring the tax system back to where it was. I mean, when you think about the Trump tax cuts and the Bush tax cuts, just to bring it back before then. What questions or comments do you have? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Let's hear from Brad in San Francisco. Hi, Brad. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. I've been trying to push a campaign slogan, which I think would actually fit the bill. It has to be short, it has to be on point. Let's make America great again. Let's return to the tax policies of the 1950s.
You want to use make America great again?
Let's return to the tax policies of the 1950s.
Thank you, Brad. When you said that, I just thought of a certain person. But what about that? Going back to tax the rich in the 50s, how do you think, Chuck, this should be discussed? And what will it take to get more media attention on this? And what are your thoughts about the framing around it?
Yeah, I mean, Brad is making a really important point, which is the tax code, really since the 50s, has become less and less progressive, meaning wealthy people pay less and less. We always think of 1980 and the Reagan administration, but it was a steady decline. And I think it's Bernie Sanders who says something like, you know, under the socialist presidency of Dwight Eisenhower, the ultra wealthy in the 1950s paid much higher effective rates. There were much steeper rates on income and wealth above certain thresholds. you know, right now you pay the same rate whether you have 40 million or, 400,000. You know, the rates are the same. So we don't have kicker top tax rates on the ultra wealthy. So I do think people don't understand just how regressive the system has become. Right. What you said at the beginning, that, you know, ordinary people are paying a higher effective tax rate than billionaires. And the more we educate and explain that, the more people say, yeah, let's go back. We can restore some of the best elements of a progressive tax system that used to exist.
Well, and that is one line right there, because we were just talking about how you really do have to explain some of these things in sound bites. I mean, especially when you're talking about certain radio and then the cable shows. So let's talk about some of the plans that are on the table. There are several plans. I mean, Senator Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren are out with tax plans. And then, like you said, Biden is now talking about this. So what are some of the plans that we need to know about?
There is the Sanders-Warren proposal to tax wealth, an annual wealth tax, which is something we don't do. We have an inheritance tax, the estate tax, but it's very, very porous, like very, very few people pay it. A lot of people, you know, plan around it. So an annual wealth tax could raise substantial money. Now there's a proposal by Senator Wyden from Oregon, the billionaire income tax, which President Biden has put into his budget proposal. That's taxing the gains of billionaires and people with wealth over $100 million. When their wealth increases over an annual, it's like a capital gains tax on the unrealized gains that the ultra wealthy get. And a member of the House just introduced a bill. Speaking of good sound bites, it's called the Babies Over Billionaires Act. Hmm. And it's again, it's a billionaire tax that would be invested in things like the early child credit and things that actually help young people at the beginning of life. Those are all proposals that are wildly popular, by the way. They poll really well. They have a majority of Republican support. But there's also things like we can have a top tax rate on income over, say, $5 million. You know, there's something called a surtax, a millionaire surtax, where you tax 5% higher income of the multimillionaires and billionaires, whether the income comes from wages or comes from investments. And that's one of the principles, is we should tax wealth like we tax work. We should probably tax work less than we tax income from wealth. All those reforms are actively in play right now, and the conversation has moved a long way in just a year.
I was just checking out this Babies Over Billionaires Act. Congressman Jamal Bowman just tweeted about it a couple days ago. He writes, there are 700 billionaires in the United States. The Babies Over Billionaires Act will ensure these billionaires pay their fair share with proper auditing and taxing. The tax code has allowed the wealthy to pay less than their fair share for too long. This also speaks, Chuck, to how the IRS has been woefully underfunded. NPR just had a piece about it the other day.
Yeah, and you mentioned that in your conversation with Ashik. I mean, you know, the IRS is like the agency everybody's supposed to hate. But what's really important is these are the folks that actually make the tax system fair. And the capacity of the IRS has been decimated over the last 15 years. I mean, they have lost their ability and the expertise to audit and oversee the ultra wealthy, who have, you know, all these paid wealth defense professionals who are gaming the system on their behalf. And this is sad because ProPublica's showed how you're more likely to be audited if you use the earned income credit, which is, you know, working families, than you are if you're using one of these exotic trusts. That's got to change. And again, you know, as part of the Build Back Better proposal that I guess we could say is stalled out or not going anywhere, there was a huge investment in the oversight and enforcement capacity of the IRS. And that's something all of us should support, particularly if it's targeted to that 0.1%, the ultra wealthy.
Well, let's hear from a few callers. Let's go to Mary in San Francisco. Hi, Mary. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for taking my call. And first to wish you, Rose, and your guest, Chuck Collins, a very happy 420.
Happy 420.
Yes, good policy is often informed by real, actual lived experience. And I think it's worthy to note that FDR, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, the president who came up with the New Deal and the Social Security Act and the GI Bill, used a wheelchair, that he ran the country from a wheelchair, he ran a war from a wheelchair, and his policy was informed by disability, by age, by veterans. So he wasn't leaving out old people, he wasn't leaving out veterans. Social Security, the GI Bill, are very much informed by Roosevelt's lived experience, and it didn't hurt that he married a brilliant woman, and Eleanor Roosevelt had much to do with this. Now, Chuck Collins, this seems to be what's missing from public policy today. You've got some good ideas about taxing wealthy, raising minimum wages, workers' benefits, but there's a missing component, which is Social Security equity and commensurate or indexing wages with our retirement. Retirement inequality is huge, and even student loan debt follows us in. They take a gouge out of our Social Security unless we apply for these income-based programs.
Well, Mary, thank you so much, and I know we owe you especially a Social Security show because it is so important, and we're definitely going to do that in the coming months. We actually have a related call on that, so let's hear from Kevin in San Francisco. Hi, Kevin.
Yes, hi, Rose. We oftentimes hear about Social Security going bankrupt, and it wouldn't happen if we had equity with the payment of Social Security taxes. That there's a cap on income subject to Social Security, which is $137,000 last year. So that means Jamie Dimon, the CEO of J.P. Morgan Chase, satisfies that requirement on day two of the year. He stops paying into it on the third day of the year because his income is $28 million. So if we dropped or eliminated the cap cap on the income subject to Social Security taxes, not only would we be able to give raises to the meager benefits current Social Security recipients are getting, it would also be funded far into the future. But no one ever talks about that. Why is that?
Yeah, Kevin, it's such a good point. Chuck?
Well, it's a great point that both Mary and Kevin are raising. And Rosie pointed out, the 25 richest people pay 3.4% of their income. Well, the families in the middle fifth pay 7.8% of their income just in payroll taxes. Payroll taxes for a lot of working people is the biggest bite. It's bigger than income taxes. And simply by lifting that cap or abolishing that cap, as Kevin proposes, not only are the ultra wealthy going to chip in more for Social Security, we could probably reduce the overall Social Security rate. As he points out, Jamie Dimon is done paying into Social Security on January 2nd, and many nurses and teachers in the Bay Area are going to pay all the way to December 31st. So it is the sort of thing that can be done. It could be you could raise the cap, or you could literally say, let's abolish the cap. All income, all wage income, maybe even capital income should have some form of Social Security withholding.
Right. And then to think about all the people who rely on Social Security to live later in life. So we definitely have to do a series of shows on Social Security. Thank you so much for those calls. We got a comment from a listener who says, and this is a great point, somehow gaming the IRS, what billionaires do, is seen as smart. The IRS needs an image change. It needs to be seen as the good guy.
I think that's a great point. They are actually on the front lines of making sure we don't become an extremely unequal kind of dynastically wealthy society, where the ultra wealthy have these huge pools of money that we can't have any meaningful tax reform unless we plug up the holes and make the system fair and make sure the ultra wealthy pay their fair share. It's just not going to work. And in fact, people won't support the system. It undermines democracy on a fundamental level when the rich opt out of paying their fair share?
Well, we have to look at the timing here, Chuck. It's April and the midterms are November. So what can be done in the coming months when it comes to legislation versus executive order and then the filibuster getting in the way?
Yeah, I think some form of investment, whether it's investing in Green New Deal or early childhood education, something hopefully will move. We have to appease the two senators from Arizona and West Virginia, but it's possible that and then the question is, how do we pay for that? And I think, just continuing to hammer away that middle-class people shouldn't be paying more. People with incomes under $400,000 should not pay anymore. This is the time to raise taxes on the ultra-wealthy. And ultimately, we should be running candidates against people who are saying, I'm going to defend the rich and not raise taxes on the rich. That's a really unpopular position. And so I think this is an opportunity to say, which side are you on? Are you helping the billionaires? Or are you going to help everyone else? And put that into play on all the issues that we're working on.
Chuck Collins is director of the Program on Inequality and the Common Good at the Institute for Policy Studies, where he co-edits inequality.org. He's the author of The Wealth Hoarders, How Billionaires Pay Millions to Hide Trillions. Chuck, thank you so much for your work, and thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Rose. Thanks for the great conversation.
Thank you. Thanks to B. Saul for producing today's show, and thanks to Kevin Vance for engineering our show. You can find more information about taxes and how your federal income taxes are spent at yourcallradio.org. And we hope you can join us for tomorrow's conversation. We will get the latest on Russia's almost 2-month invasion of Ukraine. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Thanks for joining us.